Full service radio.
Hey everybody, it's Nikki Nellis live from the gorgeous Line Hotel on Full Service Radio's Industry Night. It's supposed to be with Foodie and the Beast, but as Alexa knows, my producer, there's no Beast anymore. It's just me. No, I mean, he's still around, but he just doesn't make it on Monday nights to the show, which is actually how I prefer it. I like this to be mine and mine only. So for those of you who don't know, I'm Nikki Nellis. I do the list, areyouonit.com. It is the only e-zine in the DC metro area that goes out to over 40,000 people and tells you about every food and wine event happening in the DC metro area, as well as a long list of openings and restaurants coming soon. I do not list closings. Figure that one out on your own. But it also gave me the opportunity to do lots of other things around the food world in DC, including Foodie and the Beast, which celebrated its 10-year anniversary yesterday with a two-hour live show at Blue Jacket Brewery. We had almost everybody who's anybody in the DC food and wine industry. It was a total bacchanal, a great party. I'm eternally grateful for all those who attended and also all those who supported it. And I have still able to scrape myself together today to come and do another show here at Industry Night. So I'm very excited today because we're actually going to dive in deep on a very interesting topic. With me today is Devorah Kimmelman Block. She is founder and CEO of Cole Foods, and they are the only American producers of 100% grass-fed kosher meats. Right away, there's like so many questions there, like grass-fed, kosher, how does it all go together? What does it mean? So Devorah is really going to fill us all in. Also with Devorah is Emily Landsman. Now, she is the marketing, an operations specialist at Cole Foods. She was good enough to book this segment and is going to lend her expertise as well. But thanks to both Devorah and Emily, we are also going to be talking with on the phone to Zoe Schaefer. Now, she is content creator and media relations specialist at Rodale? I want to make sure I'm saying it right. Thank you. Rodale Institute. And so the Rodale Institute, because I learn new things every day, is a nonprofit that pioneers, that was a major pioneer in the organic movement. So in a little bit, Zoe's going to fill us in on what that means. And then we're going to find out how both Zoe and Devorah work together, especially in this massive big ag world where there is so much going on. Organic is confusing, pasture raised, kosher, you're throwing kosher in there. I mean, there's a lot of buzzwords when it comes to meats, especially in this day and age when people are looking to do local, they're trying to stay away from antibiotics, they're trying to do what's best for their bodies as well for the animals. Well, I mean, we're hoping people are, that's part of the point. So Devorah, let's start with you. What do you do? Cole, what does it mean?
Sure. Cole Foods, first of all, congratulations on your 10-year anniversary.
Oh, thank you.
It is also our 10-year anniversary.
Oh, my God, Mazel Tov. Congratulations.
So 10 years ago, I started Cole Foods. And
for those, it's K-O-L.
Right.
Not C-O-A-L. Just so
exactly,
people know.
Exactly. So it originally was an acronym, Kosher Organic Local. Now we're across the country. We send meat out via FedEx to California, to everywhere in the country. And so Kosher Organic Local didn't fit anymore, in particular the local. So now it's just Cole Foods, not the acronym. But 10 years ago, I started it. I was looking for grass-fed meat that was kosher, that I knew where it came from, that I could trust the source and the farmer. And it was sort of like farmer's market kind of meat that I was looking for.
You were looking for it to be kosher.
Right. Farmer's market kosher meat. I'd had a vegetarian kitchen for 15 years before that because... Mm-hmm. Because I didn't want to participate in the industrial meat industry. So,
well, with good reason. It's massive.
Yeah, for all sorts of reasons. And so I'd had a vegetarian kitchen. I wasn't a vegetarian. My kitchen was a vegetarian, for 15 years prior to that. And I started looking at...
Okay, wait, I have to back up. When you say that, we say kitchen. Were you catering or something, or was it just your kitchen at home?
No, just my home kitchen.
So were you... It was a dairy kitchen. You kept kosher?
Yeah, well, dairy and fish. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you kept kosher.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So for people who don't understand what it means, let's talk about what kosher means, keeping kosher.
Okay. So in the meat world, there are certain kinds of meat that you can eat and certain kinds that you can't. So, mm-hmm. for example, the best known one is pork. You're right. Not supposed to have pork. But there's all sorts of other, animals, breeds of animals that you're not, certain kinds of fish, certain kinds of birds, mm-hmm. That you're not supposed to eat. So first of all, it has to fit into the category of the animals that are okay.
I just have to say, there's so many rules.
I know.
It's really difficult.
I know.
Right?
It's hard to keep track
Yes,
of.
It is.
Okay. It's hard to keep track
And
of.
I'm a rule breaker, so it makes it even harder
there
for me.
There
you go. But go ahead.
So first of all, that's the basic. Then it how the animal is actually raised has nothing to do with kosher. So it has to fit into these particular categories of animal, but then the kosher part of it does not start until slaughter.
So really, kosher foods, other than what you're allowed and what you're not allowed, has nothing to do with the raising of the animal, the care of the animal.
Right.
It's all about how the animal...
Right.
It's what you can and can't eat. And how the animal is killed.
How it's killed and then what happens after.
Processed afterwards.
Yeah, killed
right.
and processed.
But
right.
isn't that fascinating that, like, the maybe because when the laws were put together, they were naturally pasture-raised. Do you know what I mean? There was
of course.
No big ag. So
yeah,
maybe they didn't think they had to explain to people how to take care of their animals properly.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
But it is fascinating that it's not specified.
Well, some, and it is interesting because since, the... industry has gotten more exposed, and it's the meat industry in general, not just the kosher meat industry, mm-hmm. but since it's gotten more press, more exposed, certain groups have kind of come together to say, shouldn't kosher, the term kosher, be more expansive and in some ways more strict, mm-hmm. right? Shouldn't it include animal welfare? Shouldn't it include organic or worker welfare? Should it include anything about the environment? Like, maybe we should make this,
It's very hard to be all things to all people, don't you think? I mean,
sure.
I agree with all that, but I always find whenever you're layering things on, you always are going to have detractors.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes it tough.
But the definition of kosher is fit to be eaten or fit to eat.
So it falls under the umbrella.
So, like, all these things... maybe they should be a part of that umbrella too.
Mm-hmm.
So you can also, you can have multiple certifications. So you can have your organic certification, you can have your kosher certification. And Zoe is going to, I'm sure, talk to that.
Well, we'll talk to Zoe more, about the organic, but let's talk about kosher. What does it take for, like, what's the difference between a piece of meat that is kosher or chicken or a turkey or something like that that's kosher versus... one that's not. What's
so
the difference?
It's the way it's slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
I'm not going to ask for specifics because it's something I already know, but I don't need to hear it again kind of thing. So
it's the way it's slaughtered and then what happens after it's slaughtered. It has to pass an internal inspection by the rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're looking for is sort of like historic definitions of health. So they're looking at specifically pneumonia and if the cow had any sort of signs of pneumonia. And that's really sort of, it's a classic way of how, folks like 1,000 years ago could look for the health of an animal,
okay.
Without the scientific knowledge
background
of today. So so you're looking at that you do this internal inspection. They have to pass the internal inspection. And then then sort of like organic, like the whole process has to be watched by the rabbis and monitored by the rabbis until it's packaged and sealed and stamped kosher. But so after it passes that inspection, then in America, only the four quarters of those animals that pass can mm-hmm. be certified as kosher, which is a whole, you know, it's a Sephardi versus Ashkenazi thing.
Okay.
So
wait, explain that quickly.
So in America, the kosher certifying bodies are Ashkenazi.
Right.
And Sephardim still use hindquarters and Ashkenazim don't. So, but in America, you can only get kosher certified meat that's certified by the like OU or the Star K, and they don't do, they're Ashkenazi. They don't do hindquarters. They won't certify hindquarters.
But isn't that, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here, but that sounds like a tremendous waste.
Well, the idea is that it'll go into the non-kosher market. So it's not getting thrown out.
But is it part of kosher eating not to eat hindquarters, or they just don't certify?
It's part of Sephardi kosher eating.
To eat it or not eat it?
To eat it.
Okay, but not Ashkenazi.
Right.
Huh. That's fascinating.
So it's only the four quarters that, at least in this country, can be kosher certified by mm-hmm. a national, you know, kosher certifier. And after that, they do this thing called koshering, which is this soaking and salting.
Right.
Which is supposed to be draining the animal, or draining the meat of blood,
right.
basically. Mm-hmm. So they do that, which is also very specific and very, mm-hmm. you know, detailed how they have to do it. And after that, then your product is kosher. I mean, that's a kosher product, but it's still not okay to go on like Costco's stores until, you know, it's got to be packaged and labeled and
stamped.
Still watched until it's made it all the
Such
way through the process. Yeah.
Such a pain in the neck. So, okay, so you're like, I want my kosher meat, but it's not organic. I want pasture. Like, you're recognizing the big ag, you know, how they care. Like, you know, 20 years ago, it sort of really blasted out to, I think, more in-tuned Americans that our husbandry, our animals, were not treated well on the big farms.
Yeah.
And there were people who cared and people who didn't. Clearly you did. And you were like, how do I change my meats? Because they were not making, the farmers were not, I mean, that's an extra step. You just explained what a pain in the ass it is.
Yeah.
And now you've got these little farmers who have their pasture raised. How do you get them to kosher? What happens?
Right. So it's like a niche within a niche.
Right,
and you're just layering on all these different certification bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I really got interested in this. It was less than 20 years ago with Michael Pollan.
Sure.
And like the Omnivore's
Food
Dilemma.
For God, yeah.
And that's, you know, and at the same time, it was around the same time that the agriprocessor scandal, which is a scandal with a kosher meat plant in Iowa, happened also around that same time. And they were the biggest, they were like Walmart of kosher meat.
What did they do?
It was a multiple
offenses.
Bunch of different things, but there was a raid there, and now I can't remember the year, but anyway,
there was a
raid there. And they hired a bunch of illegal immigrants, and there were also other things too. But it was multiple things, and you know, the owner went to prison. And
right. Okay, so then how do we get to you? So,
but anyway,
yes,
So that like really kind of brought not just kosher industrial meat plants to the national press,
sure.
That and Michael Pohl, I mean, it was all like
there was a
coming
lot
together,
right? Lots of red flags,
right? And just at that same time, newspapers were also looking for positive stories in the kosher world,
mm-hmm.
And I had started this like, you know, just friends and family, let's like bring a kosher slaughterer to a farm and see if we can like get some turkeys, you know, that are kosher
mm-hmm.
out of it. Not, you know, USDA certified, not kosher certified by anybody, but the one rabbi that was not nationally certified kosher. And so I had I organized a meet your meat with my congregation, and I hired this ritual slaughterer to go to the farm, and we all went out there, slaughtered, you know, like the
ranch. You were part of the whole process.
Part of the whole process. Brought home some turkeys, cooked them up, and had like a great Shabbos meal. So, so I did that. Then I just networked around, like, where could I get some beef? Like that was sort of my next, I don't know, goal. And I ended up doing the same sort of thing. Of course, you can't do beef just on a farm. You have to take it to a slaughterhouse. So I did that. And then, lo and behold, I had all this meat.
Right.
It wasn't USDA certified, and it wasn't like nationally kosher certified, but I was able to, like, I put up a website, you know, my friends and family
had it.
Well,
I would have to imagine that if you're in that community, there had to be other people like you.
Right.
Who were like, yes, I go to my farmer's market. I can't buy the meat because it's not kosher. But that's the quality of meat that I want.
Yeah.
Right?
And you don't want, and this is, you know, sort of how I set up Whole Foods, is like, you don't want to have to make that choice.
Right.
Who wants to have to make that choice, you know? And lots of people choose, you know, like regenerative or organic meat if they have to make that, if they have to make the choice between kosher and organic,
right?
They might choose organic. Lots of people do.
Okay, so you brought up a couple of topics that I do want to get into, because I want to talk about regenerative. I don't think everybody knows.
Sure.
Or maybe people know, but I feel like there's a deeper dive there.
Yeah.
And organic, because that's a huge marketing term and buzzword now. It actually meant something a point in time. Mm-hmm. I don't think it means the same thing anymore, and how to clarify that. But I want to get into Zoe.
Yeah.
Zoe, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. So
Hey. So
I think you should tell everybody a little bit about the Rodale Institute and what it does.
Yeah, sure. So we're a nonprofit. We're based in Kutztown, Pennsylvania, which is about 3.5 hours from D.C. It's eastern Pennsylvania-ish.
Mm-hmm.
We're a nonprofit. We were started by a man named J.I. Rodale, and he was working in the 40s. He was really this pioneer of the organic movement. He didn't have a farming background, but he bought a piece of land and was experimenting with organic methods, which were beginning to be talked about among a few people, Rudolf Steiner, Sir Albert Howard, Lady Eve Balfour, just a couple people scattered around the world. And he got interested in this topic. He bought this farm. He started experimenting with the techniques. He noticed that the land was improving and that his own health was improving. And he was also a publisher, so he started writing about his findings and his ideas. All of this was starting to happen around World War II. You know, nitrogen fertilizer was becoming really inexpensive and widely available because of its use in explosives, essentially, mm-hmm. in the war.
And then they needed something to do with it after the war.
Right. Well, it was used really heavily on fields, but basically the poverty of the nation's soil was sort of exposed after World War II. And that's when J.I. Rodale's publishing sort of get more popular, and these methods took off. So mm-hmm. J.I. Rodale is really considered a pioneer of the organic movement. And he founded Rodale Institute originally in the 40s. The story goes that he wrote on a chalkboard, healthy soil equals healthy food equals healthy people. And that's really been the mission. So we conduct research. We have laboratories on site and a research team. We also have a, you know, farming side of things. We're a certified organic farm, 333 acres. We do a number of different programs, but the research is really at the forefront. We're trying to figure out the most effective organic practices. We have something called the Farming Systems Trial, which is the longest running comparison of organic and conventional agriculture in North America. So mm-hmm. for the last 40 years, on a 12-acre plot, we've been comparing conventional systems and organic systems. There's a further breakdown that I'll skip from this conversation. Mm-hmm. But really, the data, we've been collecting data, and our data has shown that not only can organic yields compete with conventional, there's a misconception that organic can't feed the world, not only organic yields comparable with conventional, but in times of extreme weather, like drought or other just unusual occurrences, whether that be too much rain or not enough, organic yields can outperform conventional by up to 40%.
Okay,
they
so
organic systems.
I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. So when we
yeah,
talk about what you're doing. I mean, first of all, when you say in the 40s, it's I think that's the 1940s. I think that's fascinating because, you know, terms like organic really seem to become a part of the lexicon 20, 25 years ago. I mean, I just don't know the kind of outreach it had for years and years and years. And now I feel like, you know, you walk into a grocery store and everything is organic or natural or something like that. So when you when the Institute was initially developed, was the concept of organic initially just for vegetation or was it for animals as well?
I think it's organic has always been a philosophy, and that philosophy really starts with the use of, you know, eliminating most synthetic chemical herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers. Now it's come to encompass no GMOs. But I think from the very beginning, it's been about this philosophy of working with natural systems and improving things like biodiversity and soil health to naturally improve yields and other measures of, you know, crop and animal health without the synthetic and the toxic input.
But it was a small community
for sure.
Right, because, you know, it's really in the 50s and 60s that big ag exploded. So here you have this institute that's sort of preaching this gospel with the facts to back it up, and yet agriculture goes a totally different direction. Right?
This is true, yeah.
I mean, so what? Where was the disconnect?
I think the fact that, you know, there's a labor and technology have been changing a lot in the decades past. I think there are plenty of reasons why conventional agriculture rose to prominence, you know, and it is inexpensive and it does pump out really high yield, but all of those things come at a cost. And I think now more and more consumers are waking up to the fact that we can no longer ignore those unintended consequences. They may not have, you know, conventional agriculture isn't evil. I don't think that people are using these techniques trying to harm things. Everyone's trying to make things better, but we have to acknowledge that there are unintended consequences, both for the environment and for human health for animal welfare.
Listen, all you have to do is read, you know, a magazine or a paper to find out. I mean, I'm sure some of these consequences were unintentional, but, you know, when you're pumping antibiotics into animals that we are then ingesting, eventually that's going to be a problem. I mean, I'm not a doctor and even I can figure that out. So, you know, but when we talk about organic, let's just focus on that for just a moment. When we talk about organic, I think it can be confusing to people who see the term everywhere. It makes more sense for produce, what's organic and what's not. How does it apply to animals?
Okay. I'll try and unpack this at a higher level. So when we're talking
not that high.
Okay. When we're talking about organic, most of the time people mean USDA certified organic. There are smaller producers or even larger producers who are growing using organic techniques or abstaining from using synthetic inputs, but that aren't USDA certified. So there's a whole process in which if you want to become certified and you want to be able to sell your product with the USDA organic label, you have to go through a certain process of planning and accreditation with a USDA agent. So with organic crops, right, it's the, you know, elimination of most synthetic chemicals and also no GMOs. With livestock, it's no antibiotics.
Okay, can
no
we back up?
Hormones.
I'm going to back you up just a second. I mean, GMO is another huge buzzword right now. Yeah. Can you just give me like a 30-second, what is it, and explain it to people? Because, you know, you see all these terms, and I think people don't know. And they're like, I can't ask because it's everywhere. So clearly, everybody else knows. But I feel like there's an education gap on that.
Right. Well, GMOs are an incredibly complex topic. But to try and give you the elevator pitch, you know, a genetically modified organism, GMO, is one in which the genetic code has somehow been altered. Typically, a gene from another organism, in this case, you know, a different variety of a certain crop, they'll take a gene from that variety that's desired, whether that's resistance to disease or resistance to pests or high yielding, and then they splice that gene into the other crop so that this first crop has all of its other characteristics but now has the added benefit of whatever the desirable gene was. So
is it bad?
it depends on what, how you're looking at it. You know, I think GMOs have in very many parts of the world enabled people to grow food that they otherwise would not have been able to grow. The problem with GMOs is when you end up in a structure like what's happened with Monsanto, now Bayer, in which a chemical company owns a patent on the gene and a farmer essentially becomes subservient to the needs and desires of the chemical company.
It right, because the seeds don't farmers. Reproduce, right? You can't reuse. Isn't that Monsanto's thing? You can't reproduce the seeds, right? Isn't that the issue?
Because it's because it's patented, farmers are not allowed to save those seeds and use them again the following year. So farmers are required to purchase new seeds, new herbicide, which conveniently the chemical company also owns. Right. So it takes powers away from farmers, from rural communities, even if, you know, the science of it is sound just socially, there are too many questions and there's a better way to do things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So how does this relate? Because we are talking about kosher foods and pasture raised. How does Rodel figure into all of that?
Yeah. So to go briefly back to organic requirements for livestock, it's, you know, no antibiotics, no growth hormones, and animals have to be fed organic feed. And there are some requirements about access to the outdoors. The issue with the organic standards is that they were first conceived of in 1997 and introduced in 2002. So any way you look at it, it's been at least 15 years since they were introduced, and they haven't changed all that much. And the language around, especially the language around livestock is vague. So it makes it difficult. It means that very large farms raising a large amount of animals with limited space can sort of skirt around the true philosophy of organic and just make the requirements as they are in language. So it makes it tough to know when you're buying organic meat, you assume that that means it's healthier and that it's a better product. But we've gotten to a point where the USDA certification isn't enough to guarantee that.
Right.
So Rodel Institute, at the end of last year, we're introducing, and talk about another label, another certification, but hear me out. We introduced something called regenerative organic certification.
Okay. And what does that mean?
What does that mean? So regenerative uses USDA certified organic as a baseline.
Okay.
If firms or producers want to be, call it ROC, regenerative organic certified, they must first be USDA certified or the international equivalent. But then we take things a step further. So there are three pillars to the certification. There's soil health, animal welfare, and social fairness. And there are practices set out in the standard for the certification that hit on all of those pillars to ensure a baseline. That means that the product that's ROC, that's regenerative organic certified, the consumer knows that we've addressed concerns at every level of supply chain and that the animals were raised well, the land was taken care of, and the people involved were taken care of as well.
So, you know, I feel like a couple of years ago on my other show, we had somebody in studio and they said, if you see pasture raised or grass fed, then you know the animals have been well cared for. That was the thinking, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago. But now I'm hearing that this ROC labeling is actually ensuring that that is the case. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, and Devorah, I'm sure, can speak to this better than I can. You know, pasture raised is a good indicator, but there are also ways to cheat that label.
Right,
so if a cow has a couple mouthfuls of grass, technically that company can call it grass-fed, even if it's had corn for 90% of its life.
Okay.
So, Devorah, maybe you can.
Yeah. Do you want to pop in? Let's talk about what grass-fed means and the reason why you went that route.
Sure. So pasture-raised.
I need you a little bit more in front of the mic.
Sorry.
That's okay.
So pasture-raised is sort of like the term natural. You know, it doesn't really have official definition, and so you can use it. Anybody can use it. You know, on any,
and then charge $5 more for it.
Right. Right. So it's not regulated. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have like an actual definition. So lots of people use the word natural. Lots of people use the word, lots of companies use the word pasture raised. So you do have to be careful of what they call like greenwashing. You know, people who are trying to look like, they're doing what they're not so that they can charge more prices, which mm-hmm. is a huge problem for the companies that are trying to actually are actually doing those things, because it's very expensive. And then if we're competing with these other companies that are bringing the prices down, you know, it's very hard for us to keep going. Mm-hmm. So
well, when you were working with your farms mm-hmm. initially, was that a requirement, pasture raised, or what were your requirements?
So I'm looking at my focus is at ranches that use regenerative agriculture.
Okay.
So basically, Zoe's got the certification, so she's the expert. But my general thinking around it is that we usually think about agriculture as depleting our soil. And, I mean, for good reason. Like, really, that's what's been going on since mm-hmm. the beginning of agriculture. But it does not have to be that way. And we can use agriculture to enrich our soil. And there's, like, specific practices that that are recommended that enable soil to regenerate.
Okay.
And so that's where they got that term from. Mm-hmm. For example, using animals. So my kind of interest in this is focused on that piece. There's five different ways to do it, but my interest is in the animal agriculture.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you have animals on your land, they do multiple things. One is something that's often forgotten about is that a huge percentage, and I forget how much exactly, I'm sure Zoe might know, but a huge percentage of land is not able to grow crops. It's marginal, but it can grow. It can be pasture land,
mm-hmm.
With marginal land, it's usually like, you know, it's semi-desertish.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got an issue with drought, and it's also got an issue with flooding. And with today's like crazy
climate,
weather,
right?
There's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so farmers that are facing these, you know, weird weather conditions where they get flooding and drought, can really, really benefit from soil that is able to absorb more water.
Sure.
And soil that has regenerative qualities can do that. It is absorbed sequestered carbon from the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It's got more nutrients in it. Like it's able to hold water, and so then it can withstand both drought and flood.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there because we have to take a break.
Okay.
When we come back, I understand that process
mm-hmm.
and that this land is out there. But the question is, do we have to bring the farmers to that land to use? And how does that work? Like, I feel like there's a full cycle here, but how does that work? So when we come back, we're going to learn more about all of this because it's a pretty heady topic. This is Nikki Nellis on Industry Night at the Line Hotel. We'll be back in just a sec. We'll be right back.
is Industry Night on Full Service Radio. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. It's Nikki Nellis with Industry Night at the Line Hotel. We are having a fascinating conversation about the food that we eat. I am sitting here with Devorah Kimmelman-Block. She is with Kohl, K-O-L Foods. It is a company that does both kosher and grass-fed meats. They're the only American producer that you can buy all around the country and do. And on the phone, hold on, I want to get all my information in front of me so I say everything correctly. We have Zoe Schaefer, who is with the Brodel Institute. So Zoe, I'm just going to finish this conversation a little bit with Devorah about these pieces of land that are considered regenerative. Are farmers actively looking for these pieces of land, and are they actively using them?
So I think for the most part, it's folks that already are farmers. Mm-hmm. And they have found themselves in many times like crisis situations, mm-hmm, where their land is getting worse and worse. So okay, so they're able to do less and less with it. It's more dry, and then it's flooded, and they're, you know, looking at bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of ranchers, it's interesting, are turning to YouTube when they're looking at bankruptcy, and they're seeing like other ranchers that have produced all sorts of videos on like how they were in those same dire straits and made their way out of it. So for example, in the Dakotas, both north and south, that's fairly, you know, dry, mm-hmm, area, and a lot of farmers are faced with these issues. And if you're faced with bankruptcy, like, you know, you're willing to try all sorts of things.
Of course.
And even, you know,
well, not to mention for most of these farmers, especially in the Midwest, it's a family thing. I mean, this is their way of life. Yeah. Not a lot of people just pick up and say, yeah, I think I'll go run a enormous farm, do you know, yeah, what I mean, and just do it not knowing what it takes to run it and make it happen.
Right. So in the Dakotas, I think I was just there, 40% of the ranchers in the Dakotas are using some form of regenerative agriculture.
Interesting.
So it depends, you know, in Africa, it's become more and more popular. Mm-hmm. Like, so in, you know, in certain areas in particular, it's really, I think, starting with these places that have real significant weather issues, and farmers that are looking for, you know, really out of desperation, alternatives. And they know, like, yeah, they didn't grow up doing it this way, and their grandfathers didn't do it this way, and they're really, you know, stepping out of the fold. And
I think, must be a struggle,
yeah,
a bit. I'm sure it's a struggle.
And I know, like, a lot of their neighbors look at them like, what?
What are you doing?
You know, but then they're also curious, and they're like, is that going to work? I'm like, they're like holding back.
Right.
You know, to see if it works. But it's really helped farmers a lot.
Okay.
Because it's helping enrich their land.
Well, so one of the things we haven't talked about is how you source your product for Kohl. So how do you go about sourcing?
It is, you know, a large and it's basically what I do full time.
Right. A lot of research.
So I go to conferences. Mm-hmm. I mean, the regenerative agriculture movement is so huge now. I was just in a conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It had like 600 people there just on this.
But who's going to that?
So it is ranchers.
Okay.
And it is also just people who are interested. A lot of them are interested actually in the aspects around climate change, because, mm-hmm, in a world where you cannot depend on your government to deal with emissions,
right,
or, you know, to like, whatever, when you can't
depend
on that.
Climate change is not being addressed. We all know it. Yes.
Then this is one of the maybe most effective ways to actually draw carbon out of the atmosphere and sequester it in the ground. So at the conference that I was just at in New Mexico, it was very interesting because they were talking, one of the guys was talking about like okay, Exxon and big companies that are trying to do these, like, put together these huge machines that sequester, or don't sequester carbon, but, like, grab the carbon out of the air and stick them in some big vat. And
I feel I'm, like, envisioning, like, a Dr. Seuss kind of vacuum. Do you know what I mean? Like, sucking up the air and cleaning it.
I mean, to be honest, it's, like, really untested territory, extremely expensive.
Sure, it's like...
And look, trees do that too.
Right, I was going to say, we have our trees that do that naturally.
And pasture actually does it even better than trees do, because actually you get, I think for every... You get four times as much root system under the ground as you get above ground. So the amount of carbon that pastures can sequester mm-hmm. is even greater than trees. So why build these huge, crazy technologically, like you don't even know if it's going to work. It's like scary stuff when you could, you know, just maybe pay
go
your
back
local,
to the basics.
You know, regenerative ag guy. So, right. So one of the things they're talking about doing is basically testing how much carbon is in the soil at the beginning of every year, and then paying farmers those carbon taxes that you know, like Exxon might mm-hmm. pay or whatever to, you know, so like pay them that money for sequestering the carbon as opposed to like building a huge machine to do it
that
and paying like billions of dollars.
Sure.
For that.
Very interesting.
So,
but yeah. I feel like you, and so I want to bring you into this. So who do we need to get into understanding regenerative more? Do we need to get more farmers involved, or do we get, because I don't know how much the public knows. I feel like we have a marketing problem as far as mm-hmm. understanding the ROC and how it works. So where is your focus right now?
Yeah, well, this is something we think about quite a lot, not just with regenerative organic, but in scaling organic up in general. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, farmers can't be responsible for growing the food and also creating the market. It really, in order to incentivize more farmers to farm in this way, there needs to be a market demand so that those farmers willingly choose those methods. You know, there's been a select few people who've taken big risks and done this purely based on their deeply held values, but the other people really need some security, some financial security to go along with that. We can't blame them. So there needs to be a market first. And that's why we partnered with Patagonia and Dr. Brunner's when we introduced the certification, was because mm-hmm. brands like those have the power to tell stories that affect consumers where they're at. Mm-hmm. And we need to absolutely, education is a piece of this, awareness is a piece of this, and explaining to people why it's so important that we adopt these methods so that there's more demand.
Right. And let's talk about the certification process, because one of the things you always hear, especially when it came to organic, and I'm talking a little bit more about produce, but I mean, agriculture as well, is that livestock, it's expensive. So the small farmer who, you know, is really pasture raising, making sure the animals are healthy and it's out in the field. And, you know, I think of like Bev Eggleston, like I have a couple of farmer friends and like they're very true to what they do, but they don't have the certification because it costs too much money.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you guys grapple with that? How do you make it available to the people who want to stay true to this commitment?
There are a number of government programs available specifically to help farmers cover the cost of certification. And while that's been an argument, I think especially today with the number of programs available, people often don't realize that certification is quite affordable.
Mm-hmm. So again, do you think it's just a marketing issue that the word is not getting out, that it is affordable and it is easier to do than people think? Because once again, we are talking about people who are farmers. Their focus is on their farm.
Right.
You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, potentially. I think also, you know, at a certain point, a farmer needs to look at the market and understand that organic products earn 3 to 6 times the profits of conventional mm-hmm. and have all these benefits for their land and their bottom line, you know, going forward a lot further. And if you can actively improve your soil health, you're only going to increase the health of your farm over time.
Well, I want to interrupt you for a second because, you know, that's something we've talked about now as we talked about healthy soil, means, you know, the animals are healthy, which means you're healthy. And I want to just throw it to Emily for a second and talk about why that is so important. Sorry, just go ahead. Okay. Just like explain the importance of that and how that works.
For animal health?
Animal health. Yeah. Till then our health.
Yeah. So I really like Zoe mentioned earlier that healthy soil equals healthy food equals healthy people.
Right.
So when animals are allowed to eat what they're designed to eat and behave the way they're supposed to behave, they wind up happier, they wind up healthier, and then you are what you eat. So we wind up eating healthier animals. So cattle are natural ruminants. They're lawnmowers.
Mm-hmm.
They were designed to eat heavy cellulose grasses and flowers and whatever other kind of grass-like things they find in the ground. Mm-hmm. They weren't designed to eat corn.
Corn.
Or other grains, really. When they do, they are susceptible to bloat and other kinds of digestive problems. Mm-hmm. It upsets their gut bacteria.
Corn upsets everybody's gut. I mean, I love it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, let's be honest.
It's sweet, and so they enjoy eating it just like other grains, but it's similar to, you know, us eating a ton of junk food.
Right.
One thing in there, mm-hmm. just to add one thing. I mean, it does make their gut more acidic, which actually fosters E. coli. And so that is a product, like E. coli scares, you know, are enhanced by grain-fed animals.
Interesting. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
So when they're eating what they're supposed to eat and they're digesting naturally, they wind up healthier. There's less medical intervention needed, things like antibiotics when they're used for something like an E. coli outbreak, or that's just, it's not, it doesn't really happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me throw this out to all of you, Zoe, you as well. So what about humanely certified? Where does that fall in? Or certified humane? Right. So when I started in the food industry 15 years ago, there was a big push. They did a huge thing here in D.C. about getting things labeled certified humane, like a big stamp on products. And I mean, I was new to the world. I was just learning. I had never really thought about what was happening and how animals were treated and how we could affect change by making sure our animals are treated better. I am a full-blown carnivore. I love meat. I love all sorts of foods. But I'm also a huge animal lover, which is really hard to reconcile. But I do want those animals well taken mm-hmm. care of while they're alive. Why shouldn't they be? Yeah. But I don't think that was part of my consciousness until I really heard people talk about it and say, we should be treating these animals better, that happy animals are healthier animals and therefore actually wind up tasting better, which sounds a little sick, but that was the message then. Where do you all, Zoe, where do you feel about humane certified or certified humane?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great certification. It takes care of some of the problems with USDA certified organic being a little vague around animal welfare rules. You know, a label like humane certified helped fill in that gap. And really, that was the inspiration for Regenerative Organic Certified, is that there are so many labels out there. There's fair trade, there's humane, there's non-GMO, there's you name it. Was that consumers need one that they can look at and know, okay, this addresses all of them. But yeah, by all means, I mean, on a chemical level, if an animal is stressed, it affects the meat. Like, the way that animals are treated really does affect the product that ends up on table.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is that now that we've discussed all these labels, right? We've got organic, we got regenerative, we've got grass-fed, pasture-raised, certified humane, what? And then we have the last layer, kosher. We'll get there. But what should the general public be looking for when it comes to healthy animal meat? Zoe?
I have to admit, I don't know all of the labels that are out there specifically about meat.
Right.
I would definitely recommend looking for 100% grass-fed. That's the only way to know, because 100% that the animal wasn't, you know, just given an afternoon on grass.
Okay.
Certified humane, I would say, is another good one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Devorah. Go ahead, yeah. Zoe. Finish.
No, not at all. I'm finished.
Okay, Devorah. So when you're sourcing your product, because we haven't really talked about your sourcing, mm-hmm. when you're sourcing your product, what are your priorities?
So my priorities are I'm looking for regenerative ranches.
Okay.
Ranches that use those practices.
Okay, so once they're, so that's what you're searching out for.
That is what I'm searching out for. And I just wanted to add one other thing, because we were talking about human health, mm-hmm. and how this sort of works out for the eater. And this is true, like, for vegetables as well. Like, if you have unhealthy soils, that means that you don't have the nutrients in your soils.
Sure.
The soils, your plants aren't, or the nutrients are there, but your plants aren't able to actually take them in.
Mm-hmm.
And because we are over-fertilizing everything, you know,
sure.
So the nutrients are there, but they aren't able to be absorbed by the plants. And what that ends up meaning, like, you know,
down the road
the road, where, you know, the human is actually eating the vegetable,
mm-hmm.
we have to eat, like, our vegetables aren't as nutritious anymore, and we have to actually eat, I think they said, like, 5 times the amount that we used to have to eat not that long ago to get the same nutrition.
Fascinating.
And that, of course, makes us hungry, because we're not eating anything nutritious, even if we think we're eating well.
Right, it doesn't have the same amount of fiber, it doesn't have the same amount of vitamins, it doesn't
or nutrients.
Right, that you're used to.
Right.
Or that we're supposed to
that we're
get
supposed
from
to
it.
Have, and people, you know, don't feel satiated as a part of that. And
I just thought I was always hungry.
So
I just thought I was just one of those people who was always hungry.
So the point is like, you gotta start with the soil, and mm-hmm. that's what regenerative agriculture is about.
Okay, so you source based strictly on that?
That's my goal.
That is your goal.
And if they're,
but that's a new goal, right? I mean, when did that become a part of Whole Foods?
So the term regenerative agriculture is new. I mean, you
right,
know,
it's
this,
new.
This certification is you know, just
a couple
coming
years
out
old, right
now. But we have been like 100% grass fed for those same reasons, mm-hmm. since the beginning. So that's
so
our interest.
When you started, you went grass fed not because of taste so much, you went more because of what it does for the environment.
Well, and the animal
and the
welfare.
Animals, right. Grass fed,
welfare,
I mean, obviously,
yeah.
for the animal welfare, but now you have the second layer of what it does for the environment.
Yeah,
because I don't think most people realize, like, I thought grass fed, honestly, or pasture raised meant that we were doing something well for the animals. I didn't really realize that it was an extra bonus,
right.
of doing something well for the environment.
Right.
So then when you go to these farmers who are executing the practices, mm-hmm. that work for you, how do you sell them, okay, so now we want kosher? How do you add that layer on top of it?
Oh, it's so hard.
I bet. It sounds hard. I mean, it is.
I mean, they're basically, you know, it's hard for them because they have to take animals to specific slaughterhouses,
mm-hmm.
and they, as I said, their animals have to pass these internal inspections post-slaughter,
right.
and then I can only buy the forequarters from those, and all the rest of that goes back to the farmer, and they have to sell those things as non-kosher, and it is not a small feat, and that in a nutshell is why kosher is so expensive.
Well, that I was just gonna, you know, I was just gonna say, because kosher meat is more expensive,
yeah.
it always has been, and I think people really thought kosher meat was more expensive because of the way the animals were raised. I always thought, mm-hmm. that was part of it. I didn't realize that, you know, it needed a guided tour to its death, so to speak, and then its burial, or, you know,
yeah.
how it comes to our tables. And that sounds like a very, very expensive process.
It is, and it is very intimidating. So what do? I basically, I have to offer them more money.
Right,
you know,
of course.
I offer them more money and
but there is a
premium.
Market.
I offer them a premium to work with me.
Of course. But clearly, I mean, you've been doing this for 10 years. So there is a market for this quality of kosher foods.
Yeah.
And what
yeah.
do you offer? Like, it's not just,
I mean, it's people
meat.
Like yourself, you know, who
right.
are, they're carnivores.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, they want to do right by their animals.
Exactly.
You know, and not just do right by their animals, but do right, you know, by the environment and the land. And when you, you know, I mean, meat, beef in particular gets such a bad rep, mm-hmm. you know, from like the movies on Netflix and all this stuff. So, I mean, people are looking for like, okay, what's, you know, what's out there that does not have those qualities? Well, how can I combat that?
So, I mean, I'll be honest with you. We've had on this show and the other show, we've done Compassion Over Kindness, COK. They're completely vegan. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, one of my things with the executive director is, listen, that's your choice of lifestyle, and I get it. And if I could be more vegetarian or move more meat off of my plate, I mean, it's a struggle for me. I try. But my point to her was, if I'm eating healthy animals, you know, I'm helping a farmer stay in business, and hopefully now, apparently, I'm helping the environment as well. I mean, aren't
we
these...
We have to do regenerative.
Regenerative.
Not all of
I know.
Them. You
right.
know, just because you're eating organic doesn't mean that...
No, obviously. Well, like I said, I always looked for a grass-fed or pasture-raised. Mm-hmm. But regenerative is a new terminology. And I sort of throw this out to, before we wind up the show today, you know, I feel like the masses need to be educated on that, because it's not a buzzword yet. And I just want to know what everybody is doing, Zoe, you included, to sort of educate the public on this priority.
So how do people know what,
yeah, what
to
it
buy?
Means?
How do people know what to buy?
That regenerative is what they should be buying. That's more important than organic, and that is more important because it is organic, but it's the ultimate. It sounds like it's the ultimate stamp. So, but I don't feel like that's a well-known stamp.
Well, it's brand new.
Right. Yeah. So it's getting the word out about that.
That, and I'll let you go in a minute, but it's also a question of like, how do people, and I think this is, it's a question for us too, mm-hmm. is like, how do people find it? You
right.
know? I mean, how do you know what's going on?
I mean, if
farm,
I go to my local, so. If I go to my, I mean, obviously you're selling it and it's on your website, but if I go to my local farmer's market, if I say that to my beef farmer, is he going to look at me like, I don't know what you're talking about? I mean, how educated is everybody on it?
How educated are the farmers?
Yeah.
Well, hopefully, if you're going to a local market and you're able to talk to the farmer directly,
right?
There's a better chance that the farmer is more involved with their animals than if you just mm-hmm. went to the grocery store. So you actually have a much better.
No. That part I get.
Yeah,
I talk to my farmers, so
good.
I mean, I know that.
That's good.
But I mean, that's part of the point of going to a farmer's market. I just meant it's not a terminology I've heard. Not at the farmers markets either. So if it's not coming from them, like that's where people are going to learn it initially.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to learn it initially from those conversations. I'm definitely not hearing it in the chef world either. Mm. So, you know, I feel like there are pockets of this world where that term is not being used, where if it were, mm-hmm. more and more people would know about it.
Well, I can talk about how we try to communicate. So mm-hmm. this is our 10th anniversary year, and we've been sending out quarterly reports on the company, but also about what we do. And so two of our reports have been about regenerative agriculture and how it helps collect carbon from the atmosphere and how it helps with just fixing our soils. Just mm-hmm. And that's what we focus on. There's no sales pitch in those specific emails. It's this is what we're doing. We're happy that you're buying our stuff, but we want you to know why. We want you to know why it's important and how you are part of this whole system.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, I was at a conference on a Jewish conference on sustainability, and we're at the very, very beginnings of talking about it within that world,
within
and that's
community.
A growing movement as well.
So would you say that with that, it is assisting in Whole Foods? That more and more people are looking for kosher, regenerative. I mean, are you going to change it to regenerative instead of organic?
Well,
I mean, I know
right
it doesn't.
Now I'm at grass fed.
Right.
Am I going to? I don't know.
I was just asking. I'm just curious.
There is a whole mm-hmm. big education piece around this, and Nikki, you are at the forefront. So
I'm trying my best. I'm trying to learn as fast as I can. So, but we haven't talked about what products you actually sell. Mm-hmm. I mean. Do you want to just give a little running list of
sure.
the kind of products you sell?
Sure. So our beef and our lamb are 100% grass-fed, as we've talked about for the last right. hour. We also have fully pastured poultry. So our chickens, our turkeys, and our ducks. And it's the same kind of thing. They walk around outside. They can forage for food, seeds, any kind of leaves and grasses and flowers and bugs they find. And they exhibit their natural behaviors. They flap their wings. They go in and out of their little chicken coops as they please. In the conventional world, we talked about, you mentioned outdoor access. And as long as there's, sometimes it's just a like a
patch
very
small,
a patch of concrete, it's a very small square in a chicken house that can hold, you know, 1,000 birds, 1,500 birds. And having that one little square where they can access the outdoors means that the label outdoor access.
Right, or like free range.
Right, and that's it's just not true. So our birds are actually, like the idyllic scenes of a farm back in the day, our birds are actually living like that. We also carry heritage chickens, and we're the only ones in the kosher market. These are birds that are descended from lines that were in existence in the 1930s.
Right.
So our chickens now, our conventional chickens now, everywhere, they're built for legs and breasts. That's what people want to eat. So our chickens are actually kind of lopsided, and that's not really what chickens should be.
Right.
The birds, our heritage birds that we raise are... They're what chicken
okay,
was like
back in the day. I have to ask a
question,
though, about heritage breeds in general. We've had other farmers on the show talking about heritage breeds. But just under that non-GMO sort of heading, if the breed, did the breed go extinct? Did we lose the breed? Or it just wasn't used for food purposes anymore?
So we started breeding. I mean the collective agriculture.
The collective way.
Collectively, as other breeds were used, and again grown for these parts that people want to eat. The other ones kind of fell out of favor because they were slower growing.
Got it.
They required a little bit more space, or they needed a little bit different food, and these other birds were just easier to grow.
More sedentary.
More sedentary, right. So that's not natural behavior again. So we've gone back to that for our poultry as well.
Okay. And you're finding that the public is interested in it and wants it.
We sell out of those heritage chickens.
Yeah.
Wow, so fast.
It's hard to keep them in stock.
That's amazing. Okay, so we're done with the show. It's all over. But this was super educational, really, really interesting. Clearly, it's a much bigger topic that deserves more and more attention so that people really know where their food comes from and how it's raised and how it winds up on your plate. Zoe, are you still there?
I am.
Okay, well, I really want to thank you so much for joining us today. How can people interact with the Rodell Institute?
Yeah, the best place to go is our website, which if you can wait a couple days, by next week, our new website should be live. And we can talk about education. We've built out a whole section of the new website to really break down the basics of organic versus conventional, regenerative versus organic. What are organic farming practices? What are the issues and the priorities? Why does it matter? Frequently asked questions, it's all there. So rodellinstitute.org. We're on social media, you know, the various sites /Rodell Institute. And check us out.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Devorah, tell us where people can find what you're doing and also purchase your products.
Sure. So our website is Kohl Foods, KOLFOODS.com. And actually, we have plenty of Thanksgiving turkeys.
I was just going to say, Thanksgiving is coming up.
And we have, for our D.C. area listeners, we have a buying club that gets them really, really cheap shipping to D.C.
Fabulous.
And I think the club closes tonight at midnight.
Okay. You got a couple hours left. Six hours. You better hurry.
Buying clubs around the country. It's our last one.
Yes. Okay. Right. We have buying clubs around the country, but this is for the D.C.
And then will it launch again in 2019?
Right. I mean, we have them frequently, but the one for Thanksgiving closes
and
tonight.
And you have a newsletter?
Yes.
So people can stay abreast of what's going on? Okay. Great. Excellent. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Zoe, thank you for joining us on the phone. And I want to thank you, the listener, for tuning in. We're all, you know, whether you're a carnivore or an herbivore or however you gain your sustenance and nutrition, it is necessary to know where your food comes from and how it winds up on your plate. So I hope today provided a little bit of information to see how we need to grow as a species and learn how to feed ourselves properly. And our neighbors as well. So thank you for joining us on air today. Thank you to all of my guests. This is Nikki Nellis. It's Industry Night at the Line Hotel on Full Service Radio. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.